Good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Very well, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
So today is May 9th, 2008, and I'm now with Mr. Samuel Harbour, who is Deputy Resident Representative of the United Nations Development Programme in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Well, first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent.
Yeah, I have given my consent to this interview.
All right, thank you. Well, I'd like to start by asking you a little bit more about your personal background and the position you held before coming to UNDP in Sierra Leone.
Well, I have a master's in business administration trained in the United States of America. I returned back to Nigeria, worked in the banks. From the banks, I worked in the stock market, stock exchange. Left the stock exchange to join Ernst Young consulting firm. And from there, I left in 1986 to join the United Nations. So I've virtually been in the United Nations for about 22 years now. I started as a national officer in Nigeria, and then went on to the international service. I've worked in Gambia, I've worked in East Timor. I've assisted countries like Ethiopia, and then finally in Freetown. About 2 years ago, I came to Freetown, and here I'm in charge of the UNDP programs. I'm in charge of the UNDP programs in Freetown, Sierra Leone. And in that respect, I'm in charge of designing the strategies, linking up with our partners, and supporting most of the national development efforts.
So you were particularly interested in the police reform effort, and I was wondering if you could tell us how some of the work of UNDP and the Peace Building Commission now relates to the work of police reform.
As you are aware, Sierra Leone is a post-conflict country, and having gone through 10 years of bitter conflict, the security forces were not spared from being partisan. Following the cessation of the conflict and the signing of the Lome Accord in 2002, the police reform, or the armed forces generally, including the police reform, became sine qua non for establishing a non-partial, able, and united police force that is able to meet the demands of the state. And so from the demobilization of police people, the recruitment of new people, which was being organized by UNAMSIL with UNPOL, UNDP has always provided support, both funding for the capacity building, including the consultancies. We know that the police reform in Freetown is has been led by the UK through the UK Police Advisory Team, working in very close liaison with the UNPOL. And as you are aware, most of the UNPOL police advisors are here to provide purely advisory services, including training. Funding for most of these activities had to come from UNDP because UNAMSIL or UNOSIL didn't have resources, or were not supposed to be operational or programmatic in nature. They were supposed to be advisory and providing technical expertise. So to be able to translate their advice to operational impact, they depended on UNDP in most instances to fund most of their programs. So it's a partnership that we have had with UNPOL to translate some of the gaps they have seen capacity-wise or reform-wise into action plans, into project activities in various areas of the Sierra Leone police reform efforts.
Can you describe for us how does the process of identifying priorities work in terms of working with the Sierra Leone police, and as you were saying, with the peacekeeping mission before UNAMSIL and now the peace building mission UNIOSIL.
The major mandate for direct interaction with the Sierra Leone police rests with our UNPOL. And UNPOL have many advisors who are working with them in various units, the women, the family support unit, the traffic units, in all the cadres investigation, the anti-riot squad and all that. And in engaging with them, they are doing capacity assessments, they are doing needs assessments. And those needs assessments includes collaboration with the DFID or UK advisory team too, throughout various areas of need to be addressed. And they will then design a program of action following the identification of such gaps with the technical support of these UNPOL advisors. And once these are designed, they will then seek for funding support. The UNPOL will then come with the Sierra Leone police authorities. As you know, UNDP resources are for the development of the country, it's not ours. So every program is a national program. Then they will come to interact with us, with the national authorities, be it the Office of the President or the Office of the Minister of Finance and Economic Development, who is really in charge of coordinating UN development activities in Sierra Leone. And we will look at those priorities that have been identified and see whether it is not being dealt with by any other partner. And then we will design a program of action, a project, you know, that will address that. And once we are agreeable to that, UNDP will provide the funding through the UNPOL. We'll provide the funding through the UNPOL for addressing those challenges and those gaps. And UNPOL will be responsible to us because they know what the technical inputs are. They ensure they have oversight in terms of both the use of the resources and accounting for the resources. And they will come back to us with the Sierra Leone police to report on the use of such resources. So that is our engagement. We'll sit with them when they come up with their program of action. You know, coming from our knowledge, general knowledge of development, we'll sit with them to look at strategies. What are the best strategies? What are the best options? It's not that everything they bring in, we take it, because we also have a perspective as development practitioners to look at, will that bring the biggest impact? We keep a focus on the outcome, the results that wants to be achieved. But then there may be many strategies to achieve, or many alternatives to achieve the same strategy. So we dialogue with them, and then once we come to a consensus on the best strategy to apply, then funding is provided, and that's how we interact with them on this.
So you mentioned, in your CIL, working with the CIL and BIS, you identify the main gaps and challenges. These, some of them are very short term.
Yeah, some of them are longer term.
Can you give us some example of these, and maybe which one UNDP together with UNPOL and the Sierra Leone police decided to take on, and what's the rationale for?
Okay, what happens is that once they identify these priorities, like I said, the first filter is to look through what the UK is doing. You know, like I said, UK is the lead partner here in terms of the police reform. They sit with them to ensure that there is no duplication with what the UK is doing, and that's the first filter. You know, and so once they get to us with those kinds of activities, for it, I give you 2, 3, 1. There is a major challenge here in terms of traffic control. You know, monitoring compliance with traffic rules and traffic regulations, including conducting traffic at very odd times. And there is a police advisor on that who came in, and who, after talking with the unit, found what the gaps were, both in knowledge and in terms of equipment that they needed. So he then came with them here to talk with us, and we agreed on a program of training and capacity building, you know, including acquisition of one or two traffic lights that can be used to, you know, in major areas where they have found that, you know, those are bottlenecks and that you needed to have more than just the manual or the manned control effort to be able to quicken traffic here. So that was delivered. We also had support to women. We were very, very interested in gender issues. And so we provided two or three different supports for them to strengthen, you know, women participation and women rights. One of it is the procedures in terms of the rules of engagement for between the male and the female officers. You know, some right bill through the Assistant Inspector General in charge of training, you know, Facunda, the lady, they came to us and said, look, for many years they've never revised the rule of engagement. There's been a lot of abuses on women officers, and they needed to come up with a code of conduct for all the police officers. And so we helped them to go through the process of looking through all the rules and procedures in the police that have been there, where are the gaps, you know, drafting new ones, training people to understand what it is, and then advocating it within the police force. Also, in terms of preparing them to engage in peacekeeping efforts, a lot of the women who are in the police force had no ability to drive vehicles, and this is one of the requirements if you are going to go on a peacekeeping mission. As you are aware, one of the things the Sierra Leone police say is that they do not only want to keep the peace here, they now want to engage with the international community to also provide service, and they wanted to be involved in peacekeeping missions. But there are certain requirements for selection. As you are aware, people, there's a team that normally will come from the Department for Peacekeeping Operations in New York headquarters to test them. And one of the areas is to test them on firing. The other area is to test their ability to drive, you know, beyond every other thing. And most of these women were disadvantaged. And so the UN pool identified that they came to us. And so we provided funding for specific training for female police officers to enable them be able to drive, you know, use vehicles, operational vehicles, to enable them to sharpen their skills in shooting. You know, these are some of the things that we've also been able to do in that respect. You know, so there are various other things we've done for them. Mob control, anti-riot control. We provided support for training of the local unit commanders and other people in how to handle, you know, big crowds, you know, and control them, you know, crowd control mechanisms. You know, and we used also the funding we got from PBF to provide them equipment for crowd control. You know, while our resources were used initially to provide the training, we were able to complement that with the resources we got from the Peace Building Fund to buy the equipment, anti-riot equipment. You know, which
such as helmets and
the helmet, the batons, the tear gas, the shotguns that they need, all the whole thing, including the dresses. You know, protective dresses that they need, all that, you know, rubber bullets that they required through the PBF. And that is one of the reasons that enabled them to be really ready, operational ready for the elections and post elections, and, you know, were able to hold forth despite the potential for crisis then. They were able to maintain them because they were really operational ready and had the both the logistics and the operational capacity to deal with that. So these are some of the areas in which we've worked with them on.
So you described some of the major training programs in traffic control, empowering the women, and arguably the biggest in terms of
yeah,
size,
crowd
the riot
control,
crowd control
yeah,
was the over 2,000 policemen trained. Can you tell us what part of the support came from UNDP? Who were the trainers? How was the task of training divided?
Trainers were mostly the UN pool advisors. Fortunately, the guy who was brought in as the advisor was a Nigerian. He's no longer here, and then he worked with them to devise a program with the training school, police training school, to devise a program, and we funded those program, and that's the way it works. Like I said, they come up with the strategies, we discuss that with them, we look at ensuring that strategies are sustainable, and then they will implement that. So that's how it works with all the programs. So it's
the focus of UNDP is so sustainability,
capacity as building,
a capacity and sustainability, building, impact and outcome.
Yeah, sustainability. Yeah, that's
how do you evaluate these things?
Well, you know, if you're looking at impact are long-term things that you cannot measure immediately, but you can see what we call process indicators. And part of the process indicators was how readily did they react to situations that came during the elections, because these were training they got there. And we saw that they reacted, they were able to deal with situations that came arising during and after the elections. So at least we can see the improvement in terms of that. And also the police officers themselves, they make a report of at the end of the elections. I'm sure Rudy would have given you that. They did an assessment. How did the police perform? And that showed what were the capacity or what were the capability prior to that training, and what is it and how did they engage. And I think it showed a lot of progress. And so that's how you can measure some of those things, you know. And also the respect that they now get, because what, when you talk to many people, how do they feel? Do they feel that their police are now more able to deal with situations than they were before? So you can also get that from perception studies. And talking with people, you know, you should also be able to get a feeling of progress or otherwise.
In terms of riot control, which seems to be one of the major achievements, do you have any specific examples where so the new capability has been tested?
Many. I think Rudy will give you a lot of them in Kono, in everywhere. You know about the mining sites and all the problem they've had in the various mining areas, the attack on the various mining companies and how the police have reacted. And there are many tons and tons of them. Rudy will give you, you know, a lot of them where they've been able to really, during the elections, when the youths gathered at various polling areas to, you know, disrupt the things in town, the police was able to provide support and all that. And when there were clashes between the party, you know, various party groups, during they were able to separate them in McKinney, in Connor, in many places. There, you know, a lot of them.
International led trainings are often very expensive. Do you have one or two cost saving suggestions?
These are not internationally led training, because these police advisors are already here to provide advice through the UN. So what you do, what we have done is leveraged their capacity. They didn't bring in people from outside. They used the police training school here, and you leverage the software that were in these people's brain and areas which they have worked in to provide training. So that's the most cost-effective way. Zoning country, you know, is done with already resources that was available to UNOSIL, so we didn't need to bring any additional expert from outside. And that's how partnership works. You use both the UK police advice, you use the UN police advisors, and then you provide funding that is, you know, used for local capacity building here. So you tap into resources that already was made available there, so you don't have to repeat those resources. Otherwise, what we would have done was to look for a training institute, look for somebody to come from outside, but we didn't need that, because, you know, Ruby and his people are already here for that purpose. And all we did was provide funding to translate their ideas into actions and into that.
So the training is already available. Where does the funding? What does the funding focuses on?
All kinds of facilities. To have a training activity, you need to have a space. You need to provide stipends for people coming from all the local areas to be there. You need to have materials for training. If you're going to do crowd control, you need to have batons. Even if they are mock batons, you need to have a lot of things. You know, these are practical things, and so you need materials and inputs for those training to be really close, mock, close, real to life. And so those are costs that you have to provide for people. You need to make photocopies of material that they continue to read. You need to design curricula. You need to many things.
Arguably, there's still some way to go in the police reform, and there are probably many challenges, many gaps that are brought to your attention. So how do you prioritize, and are there tasks you think that should come before others?
Definitely. In any human endeavor, you must, knowing that resources are not all there, so you just have to prioritize. Despite the myriad of challenges, you have to say what is most needful now and what can be done on the longer term. And so the police has a long-term capacity building strategy. And so when you look into the long-term capacity building strategy, you say, what is it that is most urgent now? And if you look between last year and this year, with the two elections going on, you clearly know what the priorities should be. And the priorities would be making them ready to provide internal security, particularly for the elections. And that's where we're concentrating. Then you can then look at what services do they provide to the citizens that are most. For example, we are supposed to be dealing with small arms and light weapon control. And we are working with the police to enable them have a licensing bureau. That's one major area we are doing the work. We are the ones helping the police to establish the licensing bureau for small arms, so that we can ensure that there's arms control here, that people will know who we have a database, they have a system of licensing people and tracking people who are licensed to use guns. But that is something that is not the most important now in terms of what do you do, but it's something that is a capacity they need, both for now and for the future. So we are starting with that, including training the few officers. We brought the equipment in for them, is being installed, the officers are being trained on that, so that when the necessary legislation is in place, they can operationalize the licensing bureau. You know, so you prioritize, you look at organization, and I think the reform has come up with the organization, it's come up with the maximal number of people that the police should have. Recruitment is going on, and as recruitment is going on, training is required, both for basic ability, for crowd control and other things. And then you're looking at immediate needs like supporting elections. One of the things that is happening is also that over the years they've not had quite good logistics support, vehicles and all that. Most of their vehicles are getting old. And so through our support, the support we got from the PBF and the basket, the election basket by the donors, we are helping them to refurbish their vehicles. The vehicles will be used by National Electoral Commission to move materials and whatever. But it has a longer life than that period. So they will still, and that's why some of the vehicles are still on the road, because the injection of assistance to repair those vehicles has provided them longer-term logistics capacity to react to things. You know, so the operational readiness has been assured through those injection of things. So we look at what is required now and what will be, you know, for the future. There are many more things that they will need for a sophisticated police force. For example, you can be talking about being mobile, a lot of more vehicles, a lot of more motorcycles, but is that the most important need now? Can you afford that? So those are phases for the future. You continue to increase in beats those kinds of operational capacities, but now is the capacity in terms of knowing how to police, you know, engaging with their communities, being able to communicate effectively. We have also provided support in that, in helping them come up with a communication strategy and engaging their various publics, you know, through our communication unit. We are helping them with that. So these are some of the things. What are the immediate needs?
When you say assistance in repairing vehicles, it's both spare parts and training and maintenance?
Yeah.
Both?
Yeah, because that's also we are doing for them through the IMAT here. You know, we provide the funding to IMAT. The IMAT does all that for them.
So the British military
trainers? Yes, they do that for them, but we provide the support, the funding to through IMAT. We engage IMAT to ask them, because we want also transparency in the use of resources to ensure that it goes really to achieve the vehicles that are repaired. Not just that we give fund and we assume that vehicles are repaired and they are not repaired, so they ensure that these vehicles are repaired, because it's done by them. They send us an invoice which we pay, so they provide the spare parts. It's not just the police, so we ensure that we get results for the resources that we put in there.
Some senior Sierra Leone police argue that lots of training has been delivered by the UK in and outside the country, mm-hmm. as well as the UNPO in the past and so on, and that the really pressing needs are in terms of logistics and barracks, vehicles and so on. Does UNDP have any restrictions in terms of the kind of equipment and vehicle and the amount that it can provide? You were mentioning, for instance, earlier in terms of crowd control, that UNDP was financing rubber bullets and tear gas and all these.
Yeah, you're very right. And part of that, we don't do it. You know, any little weapon or semi-little weapon, UNDP cannot procure it directly. So what we did in this report is to identify the vendors, because we want to ensure that it's a competitive process, that the value for money is gotten, the government ordered directly. And since the Peace Building Fund had approved it, we supervised the process of getting it to ensure that there's value for money, that the right things are gotten. The specifications were done by the UK police and our UN pool. We identified worldwide those who can provide them. They certified that this is what they want. The orders were placed by the government, because we cannot place orders for those things. We are restricted from doing that. So they placed the orders. And once we know that the materials have arrived, we gave the guarantee that if the materials arrive, we will then transfer the money that PBF has given to us. So there are certain things we cannot do directly. For example, we will not get into construction, you know, because UNDP doesn't really get into construction of barracks and whatever else. But we can provide water. For example, we're engaging Arslav. We are trying to provide water for the three barracks, you know, Gorich, some other places for both the barracks and the, you know, enabling environment, you know, to improve the welfare. But we cannot get into building barracks, whether that's not the area we have expertise. We are not engineers, so we try to get away from that. So those kinds of things are not within what UNDP can do, and so we don't pretend that we do that. And I'm sure other donors at the EC are engaged in their defeat, you know, African Development Bank and the World Bank, there are, you know, many other donors that are engaged in that. So why they provide the hardware, we do the software of capacity building, providing what is required for them to, you know. The senior police officer may be right. Yes, there's been a lot of training, and there may be more training required. I don't think they have achieved the optimum capacities and, you know, competencies that are required. But yes, they want also logistics support. They have some. The question is, what is optimal? It's not just pumping them. What can they maintain? What can they sustain? Because the thing always is, we want more. But this international assistance will stop somewhere. And when it stops, are you able to maintain this large fleet that you have? Are you able to buy the space? Because you must look at what your resources are able to maintain. And I think that's the argument that is going on, both for logistics as well as the size. You know, one thing is to say, we need a police force of 20,000, but is the national resources able to maintain that size of police force? And I think those are, you know, the basis for determining what is needed now and what is needed there. They have a lot of motorcycles, they have some vehicles, but even the ones they have, it's a question of how well are they maintaining, and can they sustain the maintenance outside donor resources? So those should be the questions.
What kind of allies in the host country are essential for success?
Partnership with all donors working in the sector, with the national authorities, because they must see it that it's something that addresses their needs. Because otherwise, you can do all the best, you can think out all the best, and they say, look, we don't think this addresses our needs. Then you have failed. So we must have national ownership of the process. It has to be nationally led. And then you have to have all partners working within a defined framework to say, this is what we want to achieve, and these are the targets. It has to be agreeable so that when you're monitoring whether you're making progress, it is what has already been agreed. So somebody say, oh, but you're changing the goalposts. That's not what we thought was supposed to be efficiency. We thought that efficiency was if I can get up in the morning and get to my office and go back. But you said, no, it is how many, you know, citizens you're able to protect and all that. So those have to be defined a priori. So partnership is very, very important, both for funding, for ensuring that we don't have duplications, for ensuring that you mobilize both political, because sometimes you need to make some strong political decisions. And so the partnership helps to ground it. So it's very, 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 very key.
Are there underlying political, social, or economic conditions that have made reform harder or easier in your current job?
Yes, there are things that have made it both good and bad. Good is the fact that they are coming from, you know, crisis, and so the opportunity to start anew is there. That's what crisis brings. You know, everything breaks down, so you can rebuild. You don't have to build on old systems, and people will be less resistant to those kinds of changes. Unlike where structures are already there, and every time you want to tinker with one structure, oh, no. So that's the opportunity that is there. The difficulty is that there are no resources, no national resources. So really, leadership from the nation in terms of sustaining what is being done it has some question mark. The second thing is also the fact that you having people who have come from diverse allegiances. You know, some were working for RUF, some were working for whatever, and they find themselves now what you call strange bedfellows, you know. And so in that, you have to rebuild confidence and trust within the police force, you know. Thirdly is poverty and the pay level, the endemic poverty and the pay level. One, sometimes it makes them susceptible to corruption, to, you know, try to make up for their pay, you know, which is very, very little. You know, two, it also discourages them to give their best. Sometimes, you know, incentives are not good enough. But given the context of what other people are earning, is tolerable. But also, you know, these are some of the challenges. How do you get a guy to give 100% when he knows that at the end of the day he goes home and his family is not able to put rice on the table and all that? Is difficult. So sometimes it starts cutting edges. You know, starts skipping work or starts doing things by the side, or he gets corrupt because somebody tempts him with money because he knows he doesn't get. And so when somebody tempts him with money that overwhelms him, sometimes he can, you know, do contrary to the code of conduct you've trained him and all the things that you've told him is the best way to go. He gives in professionalism. He just, you know, lets things skip. So these are some of the challenges, you know, in here. Opportunity is there. You know, you have new people getting in. You have a new environment coming post-conflict, which means you can start afresh. You can build anew, and means you can introduce the most recent systems and processes, you know, without much resistance. But then the downside is funding, you know, the fact that there's still mistrust among them, you know, and all kinds of changes. You know, sometimes the reform means that some people have to go, and so there is some moral issue there, you know. So I think it's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag.
As one of the drawbacks, you mentioned the lack of national resources. As a side question, the Sierra Leone actually is rich in minerals and so on. Is the UNDP addressing some of the issue of management of natural resources?
We are like other partners. Every partner here is worried about the ability of the state to take care of its own responsibility. As you're aware, majority of the funds for development here come from budget support, and three or four partners are the ones providing that money. And so it's not the best situation for the country. Yes, we are worried, but we are also engaged both with the government and other partners. For example, take the. I'm not talking about the mining. Mining is a major problem in terms of how that sector works. you know, and what capacities you need to be able to monitor that sector to be able really to get your best. And it's been a problem, you know. Natural resources have been a source of a lot of the conflict everywhere, you know. And here they are, we are working with them. They've started a new cadastre system, you know, which is supposed to help them be able to define the mine lots, might be give, you know, sell them out to prospective people, get their money ahead of the time to use for infrastructure rather than waiting, because this issue of trying to get percentages, you know, there's a lot of loopholes. You don't know what quantity the persons are mining, how do you measure that, and taxes, and then it's 30% of that. So it doesn't help. So it's better for you to sell off mine slots like they do with oil plots, you know, auction them out, get large sums of money, let the person discover what he wants in there and take them for a number of years.
What they've done in the Liberia.
Yeah, the same thing. That's the way to go. And so they're looking and we're helping them to come through that kind of, you know, system, because that's what can give them the large sums of money they need to put into infrastructure and whatever else. You know, it's the taxation concept has a lot of loopholes, because you don't have, the state doesn't have the capability to know what is mined, what is not mined, you know, and some of them go through the borders, and so what is declared is far from what probably is mined, and then you tax on that. You don't even have a way of valuing what is declared to know what's the value, and then to put the tax on it. So there's a lot of, you know, so we're working with them on that. We're also looking at other avenues, increasing their potentials for agriculture here, because this is close to Europe, and you know, there are certain things that Europe needs that if they do, they have flights coming here from Brussels, SM Brussels to BMI, that can take things from here to Europe directly at cheap, and these people are going with our cargo. So we're asking them, you can explore those avenues. There's also the marine resources. A lot of people are coming to their coast and they're poaching all the good fishes. They are endowed there with a lot of marine resources, but there's no control. People are just poaching the marine resources and going away. They have no capacity to monitor their, you know, coastal area. They cannot chase those people away, so they just come into the high school, you see them, and they're cutting this and going away. And this is, you know, large potentials for resources. So we're helping them to develop those areas. Tourism, we're helping them to develop tourism. So we're working with them in various multi-sectors. You know, we're trying to create an enabling environment for private sector to come and, you know, for them to attract foreign direct investment. So we, you know, we're working in, you know, diverse areas that can open up multiple channels of opportunities for the country to be able to improve their fiscal base and ability to deliver development dividends to their people.
Coming back to police reform, are there any innovations or experiments here in Sierra Leone that either you know about or programs that you've been directly involved with you think merit more attention that we could learn from?
Well, I don't know of innovations yet, because I think what we're doing right now are basically trying to create the hub, the basic hub of what a police force should look like. And one of it is community policing, which they're trying to introduce, which is, I think that's the big thing now, that police is an affair of both the people and the police force itself, that you cannot depend, there's no way you can have one policeman to one citizen, but that once it is seen as a communal responsibility, then you can engage. And I think they are experimenting on the community police system here, which is something that is innovative, and many countries in Africa may not be practicing that. Some of them are starting it afresh. I think that's one innovative thing that is taking place. Community policing, you know, concept. It's something that is, you know, really good, and that I believe that can be, you know, shared with other countries. That's one thing that is there. You know, and also they are promoting some of their women into responsible position, gender. They're taking care of, you know, the women, and that's another area that we can really talk about.
Yeah. One last question, if you allow me. Now turning to the United Nations and the donor countries and organizations, are there some, what are some of the maybe positive aspects you've noticed in terms of relationship with host country personnel or politics, and maybe also some mistakes that may have happened or happen again and again?
In a nutshell, I can just, whether it's in the police reform or but in the whole spectrum of development, and I think it's important that when development partners engage with the national body, the sovereign state or its institutions, that we must do that as supportive, not as leading. And I think here in some in some areas, when you talk to their nationals, I get a sense that sometimes they are frustrated and saying because they don't have resources and people are bringing large sums of resources, those people then tend to neglect or ignore them and do not allow them to take ownership. You know, so we do things that are contrary to the Paris Declaration, where we said it has to be a nationally led development process. And so those are, you know, major challenges that we have to have in here, whether engaging in, with person to person, you know, you must see yourself as advising somebody and that he's your lead, rather than you being the lead and saying, this is it, this is the way to go and all that. Sometimes, you know, errors have been made in terms of getting a buy-in, ensuring that this is something that they can maintain. Because otherwise, when you leave, they will just turn the things around, you know, 360 degrees, because they will say, well, we did that because we are compelled, we had no option. So I think national ownership and national leadership sometimes have been a source of conflict, because people have seen, you know, the parties who are supposed to be supporting them rather than supporting them leading, both in ideas and in that. And sometimes you find resentments and you will find conflicts taking place. So that's a major area that we all have to deal with, whether in police reform or in the reform of the military. And also, sometimes the presence overwhelms. You know, you look at Aroslav and the IMAT. Sometimes the people feel that there's an overwhelming presence, you know, and in all the higher tiers of their hierarchy, so they feel that their sovereignty is compromised. But they may not say it. You just hear those little things. They may not say it out because they feel they are helpless in that situation. But that's the feeling you get sometimes when you talk to them and if they open up.
Mm. You have any final comment? Before we
no, I think the police reform has gone well. This is one area where they, you know, cited as very good initiative of police reform. The entire security sector reform has really gone well in this place. There's more to do, like you've talked about, the challenges in having them, good barracks, you know, good pay, you know, improving logistic support. Those are challenges that remain that still need to be, you know, talked about. And that's why there are various opinions about some people will say, well, it's been successful and not much to do. And other people are saying, no, there are still gaps that we need to address if we have to ensure that whatever we've done now doesn't get eroded. Because if we have them not staying in good barracks, that they're living, you know, where they could be influenced by their neighbors and other things, then you can compromise the efficiency, their neutrality, you know, partisanship and all that. That you know, so there's still some work to be done, and I think we should focus. We should not think that we are out of the woods. We should focus on that, build on what successes we have so far, you know, to ensure that when the development partners leave, that the country is able to continue on the path of the good story that they have. You know, they have a trim police force, if they can keep the number we're talking about and doesn't, you know, don't bloat it, if they can then improve the professionalism of some of them. There's still some that, you know, need to be out of that place and then improve the level of literacy of the kinds of people who are coming in. You know, that then can improve the overall efficiency, you know, and operations of the police force.
Well, Sam Harbour, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.